Funny thing happened on the way to the office this morning. I was looking for my sunglasses. And yes, they were on top of my head. I hadn't remembered I had put them on and then put them up there. But far from remembering where I left my sunglasses this morning, memory plays a powerful role in many aspects of our lives. From remembering faces and names, to learning new things, to making decisions, dealing with trauma and healing. It's a highly transformative force that shapes how we experience the world. And a new understanding of memory is emerging from the latest research. Our guest today helps us reframe the way we think about the everyday act of remembering and surprising ways that our brains record the past and how we use that information to understand what's important and how to imagine and plan for our futures. And yes, this research can help us with daily remembering tasks like finding our keys and also with the challenge of memory loss as we age. When we work with the brain's ability to learn and reinterpret past events, we can heal trauma, shed our biases, learn faster, and grow in self-awareness. Our guest today is Charan Ranganath, PhD. He's the author of the new book, Why We Remember, The Science of Memory and How It Shapes Us. He is a professor of psychology and neuroscience and the director of the Dynamic Memory Lab at the University of California at Davis. For over 25 years, he's studied the mechanisms in the brain that allow us to remember past events using brain imaging techniques, computational modeling, and studies of patients with memory disorders. He's been recognized with the Guggenheim Fellowship, and he lives in Davis, California. So thanks so much for visiting with us today.
Thanks for inviting me.
So let's start with the purpose. What's the purpose of memory?
I believe that the purpose of memory is not remembering, that the purpose of memory is to give us the information we need from the past to navigate the present and to plan and imagine the future.
And how does the purpose of memory change over the life course?
Well, one of the things that I say at the end of my book, and this is totally speculative, is that if you look at the way memory works across the lifespan, it changes. And I used to think for a long time, well, it changes because it's either bad or it's good. And in young adulthood, that's when memory is at its best. And in fact, I've come to believe that memory changes in ways that are actually adaptive for different stages of life. But the idea being, when we're children, we learn through observation and through play, and it's very unconstrained. And our brain, especially the prefrontal cortex, is very slow to mature, allowing us to explore the world. Well, why is it children traditionally throughout much of human history until maybe now in helicopter parenting, but why is it throughout much of human history children were able to learn through play and exploration? And it's because they had parents looking out for them and planning for their goals and their needs and protecting them. And that's when your episodic memory function, your ability to remember events, peaks basically as young adulthood. And that's also when frontal function, the functions of the prefrontal cortex, are peaking, allowing you to really use your goals in the long term to guide what you're doing in the present, right? So it gives you a very long timeline to work with and it keeps you very focused. Now, you become older, you're no longer capable of having children, but you have grandchildren, many of them, maybe from different parents and so forth. So you have kin all around. Again, this is traditionally not in modern American society, let's say. And in most human societies, I mean, I don't know enough to say whether it's most of human history, but I would argue probably most of human history, the older people were running things because they had the wisdom accrued through a lifetime of memory. And it's not about acquiring more and more episodic memories. It's really taking the knowledge that you have, which is something that's called semantic memory, and sharing it with people. And I think that's been the traditional role of older people. And I don't think it's a coincidence that the brain shows less and less of an indication of being like it's all about me, and more of an organization that's around optimism and altruism.
Starting to hear that a lot, that it's not all about me. So I'll take that as a good sign. I'm also curious about why can two people be at the same event, have the same experience, but very different memories of it?
Yeah, this is a question I get a lot, especially from siblings, where they'll say, how is it that I remember my childhood one way and my sibling remembers it totally different? So I would say that there's two reasons. First of all, is you and I, even if we're experiencing the same event, we don't experience it the same way. We bring our perspectives and our history into it. And so we're literally seeing different things. We're paying attention to different things and we're interpreting it through the lens of our beliefs and our experiences and our goals. But then on top of it, when we search backwards in memory, we view it from the perspective of where we are now. And that perspective comes with a bunch of beliefs and it comes with our moods and our emotions at the time. And it comes with, again, our sense of who we are in the now and our goals. What happens is that leads me to find certain things from the past. It's a spotlight that allows me to find certain memories, but it blinds me to others. And that's always going to be the way it is. And so what happens is that it's like if I'm with my partner and we get into a huge fight, I'm looking back at the past and I'm thinking about all of these things that went badly. I'm also feeling angry. And when I think about all the circumstances that led to the fight, I'm probably thinking more about what they did wrong as opposed to the mistakes that I made, right? So now the fight's over and I can't remember any of the things that my partner did wrong. And I don't even remember what caused the fight in the first place, right? So it's not that the memories aren't there, but we're searching for them selectively. And then the stories we make up are based on who we are now. So, I mean, it's a miracle in some ways that two people can experience the same event and even get some degree of correspondence. And we actually do pretty well, usually.
So is forgetting a feature or a flaw in how our brains are designed?
I mean, I would say it's both. It depends on how you want to look at it. But I would say, on average, it's a feature. And what I mean by that is, let's say if I went to your house and let's say you had an interior decorator that came in. They used the Marie Kondo method, organized everything all beautifully, right? What if I walked in and I said, God, this is like the most awfully decorated house ever. You've got all of this open space. Why aren't you throwing a bunch of junk in here, right? How you clearly had 10,000 t-shirts in your lifetime and you've gotten all of this junk mail and you've gotten all of, you have all this food that you threw away. Why not just throw it all in the room, right? Why keep it so organized and tidy? And that's how I think we intuitively feel about memory. Why should we throw out anything? I think there's this hoarding mentality that we have. And the problem is that comes with a cost. And the cost is if you're a hoarder, you're going to have trouble finding what you need when you need it. And the same is true for memory, that the more information you try to cram in, the more interference there's going to be. So at a minimum, you want to prioritize, right? And so I don't hear people telling me, boy, I remember this temporary password that I had from 10 years ago. That's really great. I'm so happy about this. Even if you remembered everything else, you wouldn't tell me this, right? And you certainly wouldn't tell me I remember that you're happier about remembering that temporary password than you are about remembering that you have a doctor appointment, you have to run out and get it, or something like that, right? So I think that there's this intuition that we have that we should be able to remember everything, that any inability to remember is a weakness. And I think that intuition's wrong. But of course, I lose my phone, I lose my keys. So I experience the everyday moments of frustration and of forgetting. And so I can empathize with that feeling. But on average, I think you would not want it in the opposite direction.
So what role do emotions play in how our memories are formed?
Well, they play two major roles. So one is, and I already alluded to this, our emotional states are a kind of a mental context. And what I mean by that is, they're a background in which our events are experienced, right? So if I'm in a bad mood while we did this podcast, or I'm in a happy mood when we did this podcast, that becomes part of the background of the memory that I have for this event. And later on, our moods can be cues that help us find other memories that are associated with those moments. So when if I'm in a good mood and I'm really excited about talking to you now, then another time when I'm kind of excited, it would be easier to remember this conversation than it would be if this conversation went badly. I would also probably reconstruct this memory for this experience much more positively than it really might have happened. I might have forgotten some of the gaffes that I've made over the course of this conversation, right? So that's one big role. It's part of the process of searching for memories because it's embedded in the context of our memory. There's another big role, though, which is that our emotions are often tied to very basic motivational systems in our brain. And what I mean by that is, if you look at the kinds of emotional memories that we retain, there's moments of elation or desire, stress, fear, love and attachment, surprise, excitement. All of these experiences that we have emotions for are tied to very basic chemical releases in the brain, chemicals that maybe many of your listeners have heard of, like noradrenaline, dopamine, serotonin, cortisol, maybe oxytocin. I have to look more into that, but I believe oxytocin as well. And all of these chemicals play two major roles. They shape how we pay attention and they enhance plasticity, meaning that they enable changes in our brain's connectivity patterns to happen as a result of experience. And that's the only way we can remember is if my experience in this conversation allows for certain subtle changes in the connections between neurons in my brain. So the next time I think about this conversation, I can activate all of the other facets of this experience and get some kind of a sense of remembering. So it plays this one role in kind of biologically prioritizing things that are likely to be important. If I'm feeling some sense of attachment towards someone, or if I'm feeling some sense of desire or fear, they're associated with experiences that I want to take with me, biologically speaking. If I go into a cave and I, you know, run into a bear and the bear almost kills me and I come back home, I don't want it to be like a movie that I saw, like I saw The Revenant or something. I want it to be my experience. And I want to know not only that I got attacked by the bear, but how I got there in the first place. And it turns out these plasticity changes that are promoted by things like noradrenaline and cortisol, they promote that kind of memory to allow me to really get a strong memory for what happened and also a strong memory for what led up to it.
Watch out for those bears.
That's right.
So what happens to memory as we age?
So as we get older, there's a number of trajectories memory can take. But if we want to talk about what we call sort of healthy brain aging, what you typically see is a change in the structure and the function of an area called the prefrontal cortex. So it takes up about a third of our brain. And as I mentioned, it's the area of the brain that, I mean, it's really a whole set of areas. But if you had to lay down a single function, it relates to what we call the executive functions of the brain, meaning that just like an executive in a company, it's kind of useless. You don't want them doing IT work. You don't want them trying to do the finances. Your executive should be just overseeing everything and guiding. If they're a good CEO, and many aren't, but if you're a good executive, you're going through, you have a bird's eye view of what every specialized system is doing, and you're coordinating them all towards a common goal. You have a vision of here's where we want to get to. And here's what we have to be doing now and to get to that future place. And so your executive could be locked up in a room, let's say, and not communicating at all with the lower level management and lower level staff. And a lot of the basics of the business might go on, but the company would just be unmoored and not really going anywhere in a particular direction, right? And that's kind of what happens with age, is that our central executive, so to speak, our executive functions start to decline. We're a little bit slower to catch on to when we make a mistake and slower to catch them and correct them. We have a little bit more trouble finding the information we're looking for at a given moment. It's not that we can't form memories. It's just that the memories we form can often veer towards things that are kind of irrelevant. They can often be memories which are there, but we can't find it when we need it. And so I'm left saying, hey, what was the name of that guy that I met at that thing? I can't remember. And so those are a lot of the frustrations that happen with aging. And that's healthy aging. But what's kind of cool is, as people get older, people have two big changes, or two things. One is they retain semantic memory, which is knowledge about the things that have happened in the past. The other is people tend to have a more optimistic bias. And again, these are averages. Everybody differs. And I can think of some people I know who become much more negative in their old age. But on average, people become more optimistic and remember their past more optimistically and more positively. Usually that's good. Sometimes it can be bad as people develop this myth that in the olden days, things were great and now things are terrible and the world has become a bad place. My country's gone down the toilet. My body's not working as it should, blah, blah, blah.
So that makes me curious about what are some protective measures that people take as we age?
It's a good question. And what's funny is that if you look at the study of aging, there was a long period of time where the focus was aging is decline. And it shifted about, I don't know, 20 years ago or 15 years ago towards brain health and successful aging. And so in that time, people have opened up a lot of factors, and there's more and more coming in every day. The shortest version of this is that if you want to improve your cognitive functioning, or you want to retain your cognitive functioning over time, and you want to protect your brain health, consider that your brain is the seat of the mind and it is a part of your body. It's all connected. I think a lot of people have this idea, somehow I am my mind and then my brain is my brain and my body is separate from us. And it's not, it's all connected. And so what this means is that if you're not taking care of your mental health, your emotional health, your physical health, it's going to affect your cognition and possibly increase your risk for dementia. I have talked to older adults who came in convinced that they were in the early stages of Alzheimer's disease and had to tell them, in all likelihood, you're clinically depressed, but you're functioning like somebody who is in the early stages of Alzheimer's disease, because that's what happens. On the other hand, I've seen people who are like, have talked about, they feel like they have like brain damage, but in fact, and you know, in some sense they might, but they're suffering from things like long COVID or chronic fatigue syndrome. So these inflammatory conditions can cause changes in the brain and compromise brain function. So diabetes, totally the same thing. Bad, bad, bad for brain. There's things that are kind of temporary, of course, I can get into, but I mean, if you want to get into the positives, sleep, exercise is very important. Having good habits can help you in a day-to-day level, like, you know, just minimizing the number of distractions that you have in front of you, which I kind of call memory hygiene, turning off alerts on various devices and things like that, not trying to do 10 things at the same time. So those are some factors I would say, like, we're learning about more and more. As for your older listeners, if you're having hearing problems, invest in hearing aids. Some of the work is suggesting that wearing hearing aids can preserve cognition in aging. I'm not sure why. I have some speculations on that. Dental health, very important. Turns out that now people are finding that gum disease may be associated with cognitive decline. So there's just so many of these things. The big ones, though, physical exercise, social engagement or engagement with whatever it is you're doing that gives you some sense of purpose and meaning, protecting your mental health, protecting against keeping your blood sugar levels normal, protecting against vascular disease, those factors. I mean, I think it's funny because everyone wants a drug for Alzheimer's, and I do too. But there's a lot of low-hanging fruit that's out there. And it's hard. I'm still trying to figure out ways to find time to exercise. I'm not retired yet. I probably should hire you to help me transition when this comes time. But, you know, it's hard for me to find time to do all these things. And I'm probably getting a C if you graded me on all these lifestyle factors. But I know that those are the things that you can do right now to make a difference.
So we have many of our listeners who would say, I'm not a C, I'm actually an A, I'm doing all these things. And that's great that those are the protective measures. But is there a next level? Is there one thing or two things I could do to strengthen my memory? Are there parts of memory as we age that could be even stronger?
Are there parts that can be stronger? So, like, you mean, can you, are there ways to improve, say, episodic memory? That's what you mean. Yeah. I think a big part of it is to say, I mean, first of all, we all have to accept the fact that our memories are imperfect. They're going to be incomplete. And so I think the first thing that you need to do is identify what are the specifics that you want to carry with you, right? So on the micro level, you can say to yourself, okay, I want to be better at memorizing names of people I've met. There are strategies out there to do it. I mean, and you can look up on the internet, you can buy books, and they will do a better job than I will in telling you those strategies. I have some in my head, but honestly, it's like, just go out and buy a book and you'll find them all, right? You can say, like, I want to, and then practice doing it over and over and over again. You can say that I want to be able to do a better job of, I don't know, what's another thing, of remembering where I put my keys, you know? And part of it could be put signs saying, hey, put my keys here, and just develop a habit. So you don't even need to remember, right? So sometimes it just comes down to a skill that you want to develop, right? Another thing that I suggest, and I know this is a little bit, I try to differentiate between things that I feel like are very strongly supported by evidence and things that are a little bit more of a stretch, but I feel like it's okay because it's a good thing to suggest, is I really recommend for people to do new things and get out of their comfort zone. Novelty can be hugely important. It can be anxiety provoking for some people, and you got to be careful about that. But one of the things that we know is in our work, curiosity and novelty are associated with activity in these areas of the brain that release process dopamine. Dopamine is a neuromodulator that, as I mentioned, promotes plasticity. Some work even suggests that if you, let's say, put an animal in a box and you let it explore this box that it's never been in before, so its brain gets flooded with dopamine, then you give it some task that it's trying to do, and now it will be better at remembering the things that it was doing for this task. So in other words, that dopamine can have this spreading effect. So I think that is something that will improve people's memory potentially. And also, I think that kind of engagement, I think, is just good for people in general. I think there's also just a value in feeling that you're learning. I think that it can get very easy to get into a rut and then feel like everything is the same. I mean, part of it is that I think sometimes you lose that curiosity as you get older. I know because I see this to my colleagues sometimes, and I'll say, hey, what are the findings in your lab that you're most excited about? And they'll say, nothing's new. It's all the same. We're all just rehashing the same stuff. And I find that so depressing because it's like my whole business is curiosity. And I'm a big believer in the power of curiosity.
There's so much more to learn. There's so many new angles to look at always. And you can't be bored and curious at the same time.
That's right.
Very liberating to do new things, power of novelty. And I had one more question, if you have time for one more. I just forgot for a minute, but now I remembered. So tell us what it's like to be on a sabbatical.
Oh, that's an interesting question. I think it varies depending on the person and depending on what you do. It's basically, like, let me give you an idea of what's not on being on sabbatical, what that normal life is, right? So you think, okay, you're a professor. I should just be teaching all the time. That's not at all it. So somebody who's a professor might teach four classes in a year, but two of them might be graduate classes. In any given week, you might be spending three to four hours lecturing, right? For each of those lectures, though, you're preparing the lecture material often, or you're updating lecture material. but you're also getting hundreds of emails from students. You're getting like, you're going off and you're doing office hours, you're constructing tests, you're grading. So the administrative load is just big there. But then I go to faculty meetings in my department. I have to serve on committees for hiring or serve on committees for, you name it, there is a committee for it. Think of anything in a university, there's a committee for it. Then, there's graduate student committees for somebody who I'm on their thesis committee and I have to advise them and so forth. There's my own students. I have to write grants to help get funding to do the research so that my students can do their work. So that's something. And I have to write progress reports. I mean, I'm sure I'm putting everyone to sleep just telling people about all these things, right? And so, as I mentioned, I didn't have a sabbatical while I wrote the book. This was in my free time that I had in between just thing after mind-numbing task after task after task. So being on sabbatical frees you from about 85% of those tasks. It allows you to focus on research. It allows you to focus on writing, public engagement, if you wanted to. You still have to do some things. You know, you're never free of writing grants if you do expensive research. You're never free of taking care of your students and postdoc, but you're free of a lot of it. So one time I went on sabbatical, I went to the University of Cambridge. I met a lot of people there, collaborated on a couple of research projects, and that was pretty amazing. This year, I dedicated most of it to educating people about memory and doing a lot of interviews about my book and spreading the word. And so that's been enormously valuable, tiring, but valuable.
Well, thank you so much for spending time with us and making us so much smarter about memory.
Oh, thank you for having me. This has been fun.
Time for our takeaway segment, some ideas to take forward following today's podcast conversation. Number one, build good habits. I didn't expect this week to be leading with takeaways from a conversation with the neuroscientist that echo takeaways from a conversation on what we can learn from toddlers, but it's true. A lot of the same things in both conversations are beneficial, and that's the value of things like movement, exercise, and sleep. And the conversation today with the point that if you want to focus on your cognitive health, focus on the mind-body connection and your physical and emotional health. So focus on the basics, eat right, get the right degree of movement, and the right amount of sleep. Number two, are you ready to step outside of your comfort zone? This is another theme that cuts across many conversations we've had in the podcast to the extent where I may need to take it seriously myself, and all kidding aside, I try to. And that's stepping out of your comfort zone, doing something new, engaging in novel things. What's a new skill you want to learn? What's a new thing you want to pick up? What's a new thing you want to try? So stepping outside your comfort zone can be threatening, can be scary, but it can be exceedingly good for you. Number three, is retirement right for you, or is a sabbatical possible? While there aren't a lot of formal sabbatical programs, there are often opportunities to do so. And something to think about, something to explore. Are you ready to retire? And you might be, but what would a sabbatical do for you? And how might you use that time? And would that give you a different perspective to return for another stint? Or are you ready to head off into retirement? Thanks for listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. You can browse all our episodes across 7 seasons at our website, retirementwisdom.com. You'll also find there short book summaries with key points about books that aren't often about retirement, but they're about things in life that you can really use to your advantage in this phase of life. There are also links to podcast conversations for many of those authors. Thanks for listening.